This is Sam Dharmasena, and you're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.
I like to be able to share the thoughts of community and community residents. That's why you see, even in the Black Teachers Lexington report, you see quotes from community sprinkled throughout the entire report.
That's Cheryl Case, an urban planner that has been engaging with the Eglinton West neighborhood, also known as Little Jamaica, to ensure that their voices are heard, documented, and presented to the people that decide what happens to their land. She tells me that her frustrations around the transit planning process by Metrolinx led her to create the Black Futures on Eglinton cultural mapping study and consult with community in her own way.
The cultural interests of the Black community were, you know, it was kind of like a bullet point in a sea of other conversations. And so the purpose of this report is to really give focus and attention to things that the community holds really dear. And that's very much so its ability to stay in place and to be able to thrive for years and years to come.
The study was released by CP Planning, which is Cheryl's planning firm that specializes in taking a human rights approach to urban planning. We chat about what that looks like in practice and the impacts that it's creating in her community. So, what is a cultural mapping study? Cheryl says that it asks us to broaden our mainstream definition of culture.
So, sometimes you'll see people talk about culture purely in terms of, you know, performance and consumable art, right? But culture is so much more than that. It's our relationship to ideas, it's our relationship to each other, and it's our relationship to land. And so, this cultural mapping study really focused on all the diverse sets of culture and how these relationships allow, in particular for the Black community, for them to thrive and to be in good community with others. And so, you know, while the report's called Black Futures on Eglinton, you can see that it's a future that is very inclusive and very much about supporting, you know, a diversity of people being able to thrive and to celebrate the cultural diversity of the neighborhood.
Between September 2019 and August 2020, CP Planning and Black Urbanism Toronto worked together to design and deliver the study. When they were engaging with the community, they took an approach that welcomed the Black community into the discussion. Cheryl tells me that the study references a stat from 2016 that notes that the average attendee of a local community planning consultation in Toronto is a white male homeowner over the age of 55. This stat comes from the city's Toronto Planning Review panel report, and Cheryl breaks down how this kind of underrepresentation creates harm in the community.
The city of Toronto is 51% non-white. Also, you know, about 50% renters. And even to go further, the people who are most in need of services is not the homeowner. So for that demographic, the, you know, white male homeowner with the age of 55 being the typical person signing up upon consultation is really, you know, when I talk about city planning being a practice of human rights, that in itself, the fact that the city is engaging those people primarily is one of the largest pieces of evidence of their inconsistency with the Interior Human Rights Code, which is to address the Interior Human Rights Code is a legal document in Ontario that speaks towards the need for people of diverse backgrounds, for example, you know, for Black, you know, immigrants, women, etc., to not experience discrimination in terms of their access to services.
So to draw in this crowd to their own consultation, Cheryl and her team used different methods than the city normally would. She says humanizing this process was a huge priority for them.
You know, we had kind of like more formal, like a kickoff event where we had a presentation and questions and answers. We also had poems written, you know, a reggae night where we just had people singing, and we had little shows between sets, like where me and my co-hosts would just say a little bit of stuff about planning and policy and make a couple jokes and then jump out and jump back in and then had a panel talk that like dug deep into the issue. So it made all these things feel a little bit more natural to people who are not typically involved in these processes, just making it a lot easier and a lot more engaging.
Along with documenting the voices of the community, the Black Futures on Eglinton Cultural Mapping Study categorizes things in the neighborhood as cultural assets and cultural objects. Cheryl explains what those terms mean and the impact that they ultimately have on the community.
So like cultural processes and objects, so these are things that were identified by, there was a task force that was established at the federal level of government to look into culture. Because culture is recognized as one of the four pillars of sustainability. And so cultural processes are like relationships and ideas, and they're less tangible than cultural objects, which are groups of people or events, essentially. Those are the types of the differences between the two. And so, you know, looking at the barriers, like different types of cultural process barriers, it's the cultural process barriers are the fact that, you know, the conversation and the topics of conversation often don't speak to the interests of marginalized community members. So when you look at the City of Toronto's in the Metrolinx report on Eglinton Avenue West, affordability doesn't even come up. It's again, it's like a footnote, if anything, kind of in their reports. So then why would a rent, like what's incentivizing a renter or a marginalized person to come out and to spend their hour to attend a conversation that might not actually produce any benefits to them?
She tells me what happens now that this data is gathered and community members are interested in continuing the conversation.
So, you know, that's phase two, essentially, of collaborating with those, you know, interested members to see for the funding of some of these strategies in terms of, you know, they're having staff members on their team implementing some of these ideas, providing separate funding for the implementation of these ideas. One of the items that I'm very excited about that I think is quite transformational is action number 3.2 and 3.3. So these items is really about having the conversations around anti-Blackness within the planning process and the development process itself. So going to developers of major sites and major projects and asking them, you know, what are you doing to address the, you know, anti-Black racism within the planning process and with the development process? What are the barriers that you're experiencing in being able to overcome these barriers? What kinds of, you know, changes would be needed and partnerships would be needed to help you to be a better asset to the community, as opposed to now where, you know, you're, you know, essentially in a very large way a threat to the Black community.
She adds that there are likely more urban planners that are trying to reach underrepresented communities and spark change within their firms and might not have the resources to support or execute that on their own.
I unfortunately don't think that you can count on the planning institution itself, that means planning governments and traditional planning firms, to take this knowledge and to implement it. A lot of those folks have had, you know, again, decades to be thinking about these things. Some of them might be interested in implementing these things, but the process to which they're able to put this to work is a lot slower compared to the process to which communities are able to put this to work. And so I encourage community groups, you know, across the city and across the country to start doing the work themselves. It's unfortunate. It's part of, you know, systems of discrimination that the most marginalized people are having to do most of the labor. But that's kind of the condition that we're in, right? Which is and so look for grants that are out there to fund your work. That's how I've been able to do the work of community planning. It's all funded by charities and by government.
And this type of work tends to create ripple effects.
And from there, like once you're able to get some momentum and work going, then the planning system will start to listen to you a little bit better and start to adjust. And there are definitely lots of people who would be on the planning side, on the inside, who actually would be like very enthusiastic and appreciative to see the community having these conversations, because it also makes it's easier for planners to do the right thing when it's coming from community first. That's how messy this all is. Lots of good people in the planning world want to do more, but unfortunately, many people in the planning world are actually actively disincentivizing that type of work as well.
To read the full study and the accompanying poem book, visit cpplanning.ca.
And so in the poem book, that's a space purely for the community to have their own voice. And so you can see the poetry and the thoughts of these people, and it helps to humanize this entire conversation, which is something that is very different, again, from a typical planning conversation, which is often very technical, very scientific, and very removed from the emotional aspects of human being. And so poetry is one of the most, you know, emotional, human forms of communication, right? So that's the reason for the poem book, is just to have that kind of opportunity for direct conversation between members of the community and the people who are interested in the conversations that they're having.
This is Sam Dharmasena, and you're listening to CGRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.